Bhagavatamo Supatipanno Vyasa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Tamayang Bhagavantang Sadamang Sasangang Ime hi saka ve hi atavahang Avopite hi api pujayama Saduno bante bhagava Suchira parinibhutopi Pachima janata nukampa manasa Ime sakare dukatapana kalabhute patikanhatu Amhakang dikharatang hitaya sukaya Alahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho Vija Charana Sampano Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manu Sanang Buddho Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehi pasiko opanayiko pachatang veditabo vinyuhi tamahang dhammang abhipujayami tamahang dhammang sirasanamami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichi Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yatitang Chatari Purisa Yukani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anuttarang Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu.
Hey, very good. Very good. So I'll try and finish as close as possible to 8 o'clock tonight. Probably a bit over. We'll see how we go. That's okay, not too many. Depends if they're very difficult questions. In my meditation, I noticed I was giving attention to the blackness after closing my eyes rather than the breath. I tried to relax the effort to look into the darkness and focus on the breath sensations. Please comment. Yeah, a lot of times that when you are meditating, you notice I was giving attention to the blackness after closing my eyes. You can do that for a little while. But then if you're meditating, eventually you go to something which is a bit more interesting. I'd always go to relax your body first of all. Feel the legs, the knees, the thighs, the butt. Make sure the bottom is nice and comfortable. A little bit of body awareness. The reason you do that is because to make sure, even if you're sitting on a chair, that you are comfortable. Otherwise you get in aches and pains afterwards. And then what that also does, it means you're nice and focusing, you're not thinking too much because you've got a job to do to relax the body. And also you get some comfort. And then you go inside, how peaceful are you? Remember, as I do at Nolamara all the time, as I did here, I think, that with guided meditation, make sure you relax the body, you relax the mind first of all. And then sort of darkness is okay to watch, but as long as it's enjoyable. The breath is nice to watch, again, as long as it's enjoyable. And that takes you into nice meditations. Don't worry too much, because a lot of the time the mind will take over and it will watch what it wants to watch. Dear Ajahn, some people who after a life-threatening accident or medical mishap report having a near-death experience or NDEs. Aspects of their testimony sound similar to jhanas, i.e. light, love, bliss, etc. Can you explain? Yes. Because I love that sort of stuff, NDEs. That's why anyone here, they go and have an operation. Was it? A monk recently had to have some sort of operation. And I asked him, did you get an NDE? A near-death experience? And no, more disappointing. But anyway, the near-death experiences, it's usually, I remember what Professor Pim van Lommel said in his article, it only really happens when the brain stops. Oh no, the brain stops. When the brain stops and it's just dysfunctional, that allows the mind to be free, floating above your body. And there's some great stories of NDEs. You know, people, the most amazing story was this guy came out in UK, and he said that he saw this, the plimsoll, like a little tennis shoe, on the ledge. You see this room over here, similar to like an operating theatre, but smaller, but very high walls. And there was windows up there, but you couldn't sort of from outside see in. And there was a tennis shoe on the top there. No one could see it from standing down on the ground. But this guy said, yeah, I floated out of the body, there was a tennis shoe up there. They thought it was crazy. But someone, in an operating theatre, how it got there, no one knows, but they got a ladder and they had a look, it was there. Which is pretty amazing. We could actually do that. There's no way anyone knew it was there, they could see it from where they were. But also, if ever you have read that book about Anita Murujani, her name was. This lady over in Hong Kong, she was had all sorts of cancers in her, and the doctor had to have an operation. And the operation she had, the things started to go wrong, and she died. Floated out of her body, went to the light, etc. Just, and when she merged into that light, if you listen to her commentary on it, she said it was like with God, with love, with heaven. It's just so nice. And yeah, fair enough. That's a nimitta. Nimitta experiences. If she really got very still, she'd get into that jhana state. But still, those nimittas are brilliant. Very close. But when she came out again, amazing. She came out to her body, and the first thing she said when she opened her eyes was, I'm cured. The cancer's gone. And the doctors were amazed. They said, it's not gone. He says, yes, it is, because I've realised what caused that cancer was the fact that I was trying to live up to other people's expectations. I was very successful, I was so worried and anxious in a state I couldn't really know, because it was always been there for me. Like the water for the tadpole, you don't know it's there. But once you saw that, she could relax and enjoy her life more, and the cancers did go. And her GP at the time in Hong Kong was a gentleman called Dr. Brian Walker. I don't mind saying this, he doesn't mind me saying this, because he's our local GP at Serpentine. He's also a Buddhist, and he comes here. So I can get all the extra information if I need to about what happened over there. It's just sometimes life is really weird that, you know, you read this book, and how many sort of GPs are there in Australia? And he came over to Australia after living in Hong Kong for a while, and then he sort of got the job of the GP in Serpentine, just down the road. It's our GP. So that's great. If, you know, we have an out-of-the-body experience, you know, he knows what's going on, so he doesn't freak out, which helps. Because it really changed his life. Dear Ajahn, so that's what happens, yeah, it's pretty similar. That's why I also say, if you haven't had the nimitta yet, I guarantee you will when you die. And you can have a nimitta and you can come back again and tell us all about it. Any volunteers? You always say that you don't have any fears. My parents always said, one, if you did not plan your exams and go to uni, you will not find a job. How are you going making money? Okay. For me, how much did I raise on that birthday?
2.6 million.
Yeah, 2.6 million for other people. And I've forgotten all the university stuff. You do that by not having a job. Is this called a job, being a monk? We actually have a look at it. Who in their right mind would apply for the job of a senior monk? You work all hours of the day in the week. Your pay is terrible. You don't get anything. But you can't retire because you've got no superannuation. You've got no pension. And you live in a very small cave. What else do you do? Oh, yeah. The work conditions are no good, being a monk or a nun. But the job satisfaction is enormous. And the retirement benefits... Oh, you know, when you die, they're out of this world. Okay, whatever. I'm trying to make it funny, but of course we're only here because we want to be here. If you did not plan your exams and go to uni, you will not find a job. How do you go about making money? It created enormous fear on many years. If I didn't achieve this or that, I will be in trouble. You said you were told to study as it will make you happy. Sounds like your parents never gave you fear. Indeed, sometimes you rebelled against fear. And I've been pretty fearless in my life, I must admit. This is a Kung Fu story. Did you ever learn martial arts when you were young? I never did. The only thing I knew about martial arts was a Kung Fu TV series. And what happened once, when I was visiting my mother in London, I was going from Acton to Chiswick, where the talk at the Sri Lankan temple was, and I was going there to give the talk. And that's my area, I grew up, I know that place. And so I decided to go, you know, the straightest route, but it was past a very rough part of West London. Lots of council flats there, and the police called it a hotbed of crime. And anyway, as I was walking down the road, sure enough, there was this, you know, gang of teenagers, you know, just meeting together, just looking for a bit of, as they said over there, a bit of bother. Okay, somebody knows what that means. They're just looking for something to do at the night time. And so I was walking in their direction, you know, always in my robes, that's all I got. And so as I was walking towards them, they looked at me, and that's when they started chanting, Buddha, 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 Buddha. It was not loving kindness, it was the opposite. Trying to wind me up and make me scared. There's about 14 or 15 of these young men, Buddha, Buddha. As I got closer, they started increasing the volume and also doing it faster. Buddha, 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 Buddha. So what could I do? I could have gone on the other side of the road. I could have turned around and gone back. Nah, I'm not into that. So what this is opposite. I'm not a crazy monk. As I got closer, I was just walking the same speed, and they're all looking at me, Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. And then I raised my hands in a kung fu pose. It was totally fake. I didn't know what I was doing. But I had the robes, the bald head, and the confidence, and that's all I needed. And they parted. And I walked right through them and just carried on walking. They never touched me. I wish that had been on videoed or something. That would be really cool. And that was my kung fu. Because sometimes if you don't have that type of fear, then, you know, people just, a lot of times they challenge you because they want to see if you're a real monk or not. And if, you know, you're a real monk, you just, there's nice and calm and quiet, there's no problem at all. And I'm pushing my luck, I must admit, but I've done that many times. What was the other time that in Bunbury Beach, when that was a time that it was Rajneesh and the orange people, they were coming to Perth, so it was said, and so they were on the news, and people hated them at that time. And I was at Bunbury Beach, just meditating there, nice and quietly. That was because I used to go to the prison in the evening, and I had a free afternoon, so I went down there to meditate. And then I suddenly heard this noise. Get off our beach, Rajneeshi. And then a stone flew past my ear. And then, get off our beach, and another stone went past. And then I thought, look, if I just sit there, sooner or later, just it's a matter of probability theory, because I did mathematics at university, I know my probability theory. So it's not a good idea just to sit there. So I got up. When I got up and turned around, so there was about six or seven sort of young, maybe 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds. And so, but instead of running away, that's not a good thing to do, I just turned around and walked towards them. And as they never expect me to walk towards them, they were throwing stones at me, it made the aim much easier. I was getting closer. But what they did was they all ran away. I don't know why, just they're scared of. But anyway, as I got closer towards them, one of them stayed. And the other ones ran a distance. And as I got closer to the one who stayed, I said, well, you're throwing stones at me. I'm not a Rajneeshi, I'm a Buddhist monk. And even if I was a Rajneeshi, it's not nice to throw stones at people. And I said, you're a Buddhist monk? Yes, totally different. We're just meditating, being peaceful, doing kind things for people. This evening I'm going to the prison to teach the prisoners. I said, oh, really? And I had about 5 or 10 minutes chat with them about Buddhism. And it was wonderful that you could do that, which meant that I wasn't scared. But I must admit, there was one time I was really afraid. But it wasn't of like boys and stuff throwing rocks at me or trying to beat me up. It was just a situation which I got myself into, which was very, very difficult. Because I was, again, in Bunbury Beach, this is why I remember this. And just, you know, in the afternoon, I went out to the beach there and just sat down nice and peacefully, a beautiful day. And it was about this time of year as well. I know that, and I'll tell you why in a few moments. Because I was sitting there just really quietly, and it was nice and comfortable. I sat there for 2 hours, my eyes closed, having a nice meditation. And when I came out, there's no one there when I closed my eyes. When I came out, there was quite a few young people there. But most importantly, there was somebody sitting to my left, right next to me, and someone sitting to my right, right next to me. When I looked who they were, the one sitting on my right was a 17-year-old blonde in a bikini. Girl. in a bikini. Okay, you wait these days. I mean, but that was a long time ago. So there's a girl in a bikini, some blonde hair. Honestly, it wasn't. And on my right, it was a redhead in a bikini. What's going on? And honestly, if somebody had photographed that and sent it to the Thai community, I'd be dead. How can you explain that? Here's Ajahn Brahm on Bunbury Beach sitting with his two girlfriends. I was afraid of that. But all it really was, I knew it was this time of the year because it was the day after the year 12 exams finished. And it was just the high school, just on the opposite side of the road to where I was sitting. No one was at the beach when I was there. But then they finished the last exam of year 12. Yay! And what did they do? It was a nice afternoon. Get into your bathers, down on the beach and celebrate. And these two girls saw this weirdo, sitting on the beach, brown robes, bald head, and sitting really peacefully, you know, for a couple of hours. And they say, we're just sitting waiting for you to come out of your meditation, because it's really interesting. We just want to ask a couple of questions about meditation. It's really inspiring. And so they weren't what you could call appropriately dressed to listen to Dhamma. But then I always remember Patachara. She had nothing on at all. But anyway, I just was kind to them and just said a few things to them about meditation and said, I've got to go now. And so I got up and they said, thank you. But it's one of those really weird things of being a monk. Sometimes the situations you get yourself into, no intention at all of doing anything wrong, but can so easily be misunderstood and misconstrued. So that always makes sure you go to the right places and don't do the wrong things. Another time, there was going to some award ceremony. And the way they held the award ceremony was in Burswood Casino. No, Burswood Hotel. I remember going there, I got Sol Hanna to take me over there. He was the president at the time. And it was really raining. So, you know, we didn't really know where we could park, where we were going. We parked as close to one of the doors as possible and went into the big building. I'd never been in there before. I don't know the ways and which way to go here, which way to go there. And when I went in, and Saul had never been, our president had never been to the casino before, he didn't know which way to go. So we're totally lost. And then suddenly we turned a corner and then there was all these lights and flashing things. Like, oh my goodness, get out of here. I don't know which way we're going to go, but let's get out quick. Because what would happen if they saw Ajahn Brahm and the president of the Buddhist Society going to the casino on a Sunday night, I think it was. We were just lost. Oh yeah, we've heard that before. But fortunately, no one saw us. Thank goodness for that. But if a monk did go into the casino, what would happen? I can't resist this story. This story is a very famous nun. She's not here anymore. So she passed away some years ago. A long time ago. And I love this story. This nun, she was teaching a retreat in England. And after she finished the retreat, she had to go to Heathrow Airport to get a plane, I think, to go to Germany, I think. And then she had an attendant with her. And because of the timing, they had to get a lunch before they got to the airport. And the only place they could get a lunch was in one of these buildings where they had it was like a pub, but the restaurant was next to it. We had to go past the pub, you know, in and just through the doors, not stopping in the pub, the British pub, to get to the restaurant. So they went through, you know, not stopping in the restaurant, also not stopping in the pub, through the pub into the restaurant, and then they got their meal. And after they finished the meal, then the nun was still eating a little bit, and so the attendant, you know, paid the bill, and she had a couple of pounds left over. It was not enough money to go to, you know, the foreign exchange counter at the airport and change anything. So he had a couple of pounds, and there's one of these slot machines, these what they call pokies over here. So the attendant put some coins in the slot machine and poured it once, didn't get anywhere. And then she put another coin in the slot, a last coin, just as this nun came out. And as this nun came out, the attendant said, "You've got the good karma, you pull the handle." Don't ever do that, sisters. Because what happened next? I checked it out. It was really, it happened. The nun pulled the handle. And my goodness, things went round and round. You can't make these stories up. It happened. It was the jackpot. Ding, 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 or whatever it does. And all this money came out. Heaps and heaps of money. Onto the nun's robe. And everybody in the pub just went totally quiet. And the barman who was serving apparently rang the bell. What does that mean? It's our tradition. You know how English always have traditions. Our tradition, whoever wins the lottery, or the prize there, and that was the nun, whoever wins has to buy everybody in the bar at the time a drink. Of whatever they want. So it was a time this very well-known nun brought gin and tonics, double whiskies, beers for everybody who happened to be in the bar at the time. Very embarrassing. So be careful. Who was that nun? Do you know?
Yes. Akima.
It was her. Oh, dearie me. So please keep away from casinos or slot machines or anything, because, you know, you're liable to win. And you get in big trouble then. Could you please explain why meat eating is allowed in Theravada Buddhism? Surely it involves killing, even if someone in the slaughterhouse does it for us. The reason is, was because not in slaughterhouses. When I was in Thailand, it was the villagers. They got the fish, they got the frogs, they got the snails and whatever else was caught in there, because it was subsistence living. So, and these days, I still eat meat. One of the reasons I do that is because I'll be honest with you, no one ever adds garlic or chili or anything else. So it's like it's English food, basically, and that's what I seem to my tummy really gets up, is comfortable with. But I must admit, about 3 years ago, I went to one of these retreats. Venerable Chanda was organising it in England, and it was run by this retreat house, and they served vegetarian food. But it was like English style, like meat and, not so meat, like potatoes and baked beans and stuff. And that was the sort of stuff my tummy is used to. And I was fine on that. But sometimes over here I look and see what's there. I don't know what spices and stuff get put into the food. And some of it really makes me sick. I remember on one of my birthdays years ago, I think, where was it? Was it the thing that Hilton over here in Perth? No, they tried to get some decent food from me. It was some pumpkin soup, but it had chili, garlic. What else have you got? It had something in there, just an ordinary spice. I think it was garlic. No, it was what makes you warm?
Ginger.
It had ginger in it. And that really made me sick in the evening. I had a very sort of bad tummy. So even little things like that are some of the reason why. So the simplest food, the better. And as a monk, you don't know what they put in the food. Honestly. You go on those tables, you've been in the tables at Bodhinyana Monastery, and you've got all sorts of food there. And I can't ask everybody, which one is yours? What do you put in there? So anyway, we try and do the best. And the other thing was that once the Buddha was asked, You know, it was by Devadatta. Can you make a rule so that all of the monks and the nuns are vegetarians? And he refused. I always wondered why he refused that. I think the reason why the Buddha refused to make that a rule was to make sure that it was more easy for all people from whatever background, wherever you come from, you know, to survive as a monk. I don't know how it is at Dhammasara, but certainly over in many of the monasteries in Sri Lanka and also in Burma, I'm not quite sure in Thailand, but one of the biggest health problems for monastics is bad digestion. And a lot of the time it's not because only eating one meal a day or in the morning, in the afternoon, only at lunchtime. A lot of it is because you don't really know what you're eating. And you can't have, I don't know how many monks, 20, 22 monks, sort of saying exactly what they want to eat and how to eat it. But you know, we survive. But sometimes some monks have problems with their tummies. Anyway, I think that's one of the reasons why the Buddha sort of tried to make it as simple as possible. The meats obviously we can't eat. If anything was killed for us, just for us, then we can't eat it. You know, I told you those stories about eating really gross food, frog soup. You looked in the pot, it was just passed down to the only thing you had to add to your rice. It was just, these frogs were floating in the hot water. There was no salt, no seasoning at all. It was just water and frog and rice. That's it. No fruits, no vegetables, nothing was there. It was a very poor part of the world. And so those were just usual foods. And this one day, this man he'd married, a local woman, not in sort of close to our monastery, but about 20, 30 miles away. And he said he was raising, not chickens, turkeys. And he said, you know, it's only a week or two to Christmas. Would you like a turkey for Christmas? And I must admit, even though I was a vegetarian before, I was a monk for quite a few years, I thought, oh wow, Western food, turkey for Christmas. And I got really excited. And then he said, I'll choose a fat one for you and kill it myself. Aww. Yeah, you know the rule. I said, oh, why did you say that? Because we can't do that at all. If anything is killed specifically for the monks or the nuns, you have to not take it. So anyway, all sorts of stuff we used to do there. Anyway, question from Singapore. How do we reconcile between being content and easily satisfied and having aspirations? Again, all your aspirations, you start with aspirations and then they lead to desperations and then expirations. In other words, there comes a time when you do your work and all the aspirations which I've done in my life, it's building monasteries and ordaining bhikkhunis and nice retreat center and teaching the Dhamma properly. Do I have to keep having aspirations? Can't I stop? Can't you stop? What is the difference between aspiration and desire and craving? There is actually no real difference. The only difference is aspiration is a nice word for the same thing. So if you really want to go on a retreat and get some really deep meditations, see if you can put aside all your aspirations and just let go, relax. Just be here with no aspirations at all. Then if you want to go back to work afterwards, fine. Then you have your aspirations. But you'll find it's very complicated having aspirations. It should be easy to achieve, but you find it so difficult. And make sure you don't allow disappointment and frustration and blaming and anger to get in the way of those aspirations. Because sometimes all the bad stuff which comes up, it comes up from a good seed, wanting to do something good for the world. But then after a while, it turns to conflict and argument. So I think it would be wonderful if more people were content and easily satisfied. We wouldn't need so much. To what extent do the elements of trust and knowing play in the process of letting go? For example, I trust that if and when I let go, I know that I see nimittas. Is this a correct understanding? Be careful there, because if it's trust, so you get something, if I let go, then I would see nimittas. And that won't work, because you're not really trusting. You're not really letting go. You're letting go to get something. It's another means to an end. So instead, if you learn to be content and easily satisfied, if nimittas come, wonderful. If they don't come, just the same. That type of attitude, then these things will always happen. Because the nimittas, all it really is just the lake is so still. You don't want anything. You don't disturb it. Because of that, you get these beautiful reflections in the water of the full moon. That's why that's a beautiful simile. It's only when the water is perfectly still does it act like a mirror. And on a full moon night, there's a full moon night coming up in a couple of days' time. And when it's perfect, then you can see the reflection of the full moon in the still waters of the pond. It's where you can see beautiful nimittas in the still waters of your mind. Only when you're still. But aspire for something, you find these things never happen. If you trust that when I let go, that you see the nimittas, then if it doesn't work the first time, you'll give up. And you'll find out it's because you're not really trusting. Based on what you said during today's sutta class, did the Buddha die because he had no more will to live? Ha 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 ha. Yeah. He made an aspiration. No, it wasn't an aspiration, it was a determination. That the Mara, after the Buddha's enlightenment, Mara asked him, okay, you're enlightened now, great. Don't have any more aspirations, that just causes conflict and trouble, just disappear now. He was just trying to get rid of the Buddha, and the Buddha said, no, I will not enter Parinibbana until, this is a great saying, until I have established a large number of lay men and women wearing white, keeping precepts. I'm just changing the order around. And until I've established a large flourishing sangha of bhikkhus in brown, and until I have established a large sangha of bhikkhunis. You. He said, I will not retire. I will not retire from this world until that has been done. That was his mission, his purpose in life. It was said to Mara just after the Buddha's enlightenment, still in Bodh Gaya. And then 80 years later, or just under 80 years, no, not 80 years later, 45 years later, under the Chapala shrine in Vaisali, Mara came to him again and said, you've done it. You fulfilled your vow. There's a flourishing number of lay men, lay women, lots and lots of monks and lots of bhikkhunis. And the Buddha said, that's true. Says he can go now, fair enough. And so the Buddha said, in 3 months' time, I will pass away. Give up his life faculty. So did the Buddha commit suicide? I often say this, just to stir people up about what this means. The Buddha decided for himself that this is the time to go. Is that suicide? Even they say, well, but he ate this pork, which was, he said, it's the only one who can eat it. But he knew it. So what did he eat it for? You can answer that question for me. Okay. And so I would say the Buddha passed into Parinibbana because those four vows were complete. And I always mention that and make a big point of it because that's pretty honest. And that's why it's really important, if you have faith in the Buddha, believe in the Buddha, and just trust his wisdom, then for goodness sake, let's get some more bhikkhuni monasteries around the world. That's what the Buddha meant to do. So, let's make it happen. I'm reading today's sutta at Nalakapana, and specifically paragraph number 7, the sentence that says, it is a while that the Tathagata uses one thing after reflecting. Is it difficult to understand with the multiple use of another thing? Can't explain what is meant by another thing with metta. It means something else. Okay, I don't know what it means. I haven't got the context here. Okay, so this question, because it's always nice to put a question aside. Don't open it. I've got no good excuse now to put this aside and have a look at the quote this evening, and I can tell you tomorrow. Is that okay? Yeah. Otherwise, I'd go over time again and get into trouble. I've got these questions to do. I've got 13 minutes. Oh, one less question to do. An irrational fear of people has for a long time impacted my peace, my relationships, even with myself. I realize I create and further develop these perceptions. The impact I'm beginning to see is also there here in meditation. Perhaps a relaxed question is, how do I relax around this? First of all, hang around good people. If you hang around good people, you've got nothing to be afraid of. People here, I guarantee the goodness of all the people in this retreat center. So if you can't be relaxed around people here, am I violent? Am I pathological? Is that right? No, nothing ever happens here which is harmful or hurtful to you. And people are just so...
Pathological joker.
Psychological joker, okay. Yeah, that's true. Never harmed anybody. And look, how many doctors have we got in this place? I don't know why, we have heaps of doctors come here and nurses as well. So, I mean, we're pretty safe here. If something happens to you, you don't just get a good nurse to look after you, and you get doctors to look after you, and heaps of them, so you're pretty safe, and we'll all be for free. And if it can't cure you, we've got the funeral director over there, and I'll do the chanting for free. So it's amazing, just the service and all the support systems we have in this place. Wow. So anyway, and when you realize just how safe you are here, and these people over here you can trust, and afterwards, when you go back, you can always tell people you can trust and people you can't trust, and people always got this goodness inside of them. So all those prisoners I went to see, and they had this beautiful goodness inside of them. You looked in there, you saw it, and that's what grew. And however you look at the people who you meet, that's what they show you back. If you look at people with fear, because you think they can do bad things, and that's what they'll show you. If you think they can do good things, then they'll show you beautiful things. So I've always found in my life, and just even animals as well, snakes would crawl on you or fall on you in Thailand. They never harm you. And one of the things which, I don't know why people think it's funny, I thought it was really nice and cute. In the hot weather in Thailand, But sometimes you would just have your lower robe on, you know, when you're taking a rest, really hot weather. And sometimes the tarantulas, the big spiders, would fall from the roof because of the hot weather. They'd fall on you, on your bare chest. And go, boom. It was a real tarantula, but they would never harm you. I kind of liked it. You didn't have much sensory stimulation as a young monk, but at least you had these, they've got little hairy legs, and they're really quite tickly as they walk over you. So yeah, do it any time, tarantula. That's honest. So thank you for mentioning all the fun ways of breathing. I've heard people to see that it's best to not control the breathing, but to let it come naturally. Yes, health with letting go. Can you say something about that? Again, it just happens naturally. The only thing you can do is to interfere with it. But just doing that little bit of fun breathing was just to give you a little bit of playtime. You know, everyone needs playtime. If you have some playtime, just a little bit of fun, a little bit of joy, especially if you get tired, what that really means is that you just go for a walk or something. When I was looking at those suttas on my machine, there's also on there, I'm going to get into trouble for this one, I'm sure, that there was, when I was in Penang, they asked me to demonstrate a different type of walking meditation. Because it's really important that Buddhism, when it goes to different countries, adapts to the local culture. And so I demonstrated... I was just looking at the nuns if I can dob one of you in. You will? Okay, great. Okay. Okay, we're going to go over time again, but I think it's worth it. Can you stand up? You know, this kangaroo walking meditation. No. Mindfully, please. Mindfully. Okay. Instead of walk. Okay, enough. Instead of walking to left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. We do it Australian style. You hop.
The Brits have the Ministry of Silly Walks.
Yeah, see, but we're not in Britain now, so we can't do that here. That's Monty Python. But when I taught that before, and because there was no nuns in Penang at that time, so I did it myself, just to show. And of course, you know what happened. The mobile phones came out, and they filmed me before I could stop. So anyway, if you find that people are getting a bit depressed, or tired, or in just a hot afternoon or something, and you in one of the walking meditation halls there, and you see they're just walking, there are no smiles on their face, you try the kangaroo walking meditation method. And it brings smiles to everybody's faces. It brings them joy. And as a result of that joy and happiness, then they can walk much more peacefully. It actually works. Anyway, I better... Thank you very much. A round of sadhu, sadhu, sadhu for doing that. Excellent. Dear Ajahn, in the sutta this afternoon, the several paragraphs end. She, he directs her, his mind to such a state. In this way, too, a bhikkhu lay follows has a comfortable abiding. Ajahn, what does a comfortable abiding mean? That's usually jhanas. What is its content? Oh, just the content of that person's practice. In other words, you see what was, you know, there, how they understood precepts. Were they really sort of forceful and their precepts? And I mustn't touch anything, I mustn't do anything, I mustn't... And afraid? They weren't too afraid to break a precept? Or are they just relaxed with the precepts? Relax with the precepts doesn't mean breaking them. After all these years, 47 years as a monk, I found out that the precepts are natural. You don't have to sort of worry about them. Just, who wants to break them? they're not attractive to breaking precepts anymore. So you just keep them because it's the obvious thing to do. So because of that, you're not really held tightly by precepts. They're the freedom from desire. Freedom from desire, you're free at last. Whoa, it's great. I don't have to watch the TV. I don't have to. What else do people do? To go to bars. I don't have to. What else do? Breaking precepts. I don't know. But anyway, because there's so much stuff you don't have to do, you feel so free. Okay, that's one of the reasons why a policeman comes to the monastery. Hi, how can I help you? You don't have any fear. You haven't done anything. So it's nice. You're free from so much when you keep your precepts. And is it Uttaminusa state that some as the attainment being reflected on each different case of the sutta? Yeah, it is when you see just all these people sort of getting these incredible meditations. Look, I get inspired by teaching you and see that some of you, they come into the meetings or into the interviews and you say these incredible things which you've experienced or how it's changed your life. And even things like that, it's just so inspiring. That's why I don't mind teaching more. Sometimes I think, well, 70 years old now, can I give this job to other monks to do or other nuns to do? So now I enjoy it. What gives me the most happiness is like when you come in and I hear some of you say, you know, what has happened to you in your meditation. That's beautiful. So, that's why even you inspire me. Could you please explain the eight parts of the Eightfold Noble Path and how following this suppresses or weakens the five hindrances? Oh my goodness, I've got 3 minutes to go. The eight parts of the Eightfold Path. First of all, the right view. The right view is you don't really want anything. You see the dangers of wanting. You see, who wants to have ill will? That just, if you have ill will, there's all these incredible similes. It's like getting a handful of, say, feces and throwing at someone because, you know, you're angry at them. Most times you'll miss them. But you've always got the dirt on your hand, the muck on your hand. Ill will always hurts you much more than anybody else. It's just not worth it. Someone's done something wrong, karma will get the BASTRDS anyway. And the next one, the right intention. It's not right intention, it's right motivation to be accurate. Right motivation is making sure that you don't do that you're coming from just letting go, renunciation. So if you come from renunciation, you don't, restlessness and remorse just don't come up. And you don't desire anything, you just want to give up things. And you come to being kind. Imagine how kindness overcomes and weakens those hindrances. Don't desire, no ill will, you've got kindness instead. And that's how kindness protects you, don't have fear. So, and that's just the second factor of the Eightfold Path. Third, fourth, fifth factors, that's right speech, right action, right livelihood. It's all out of kindness. You speak out of kindness. You don't act out of ill will. And you just have a gentle lifestyle. And you have, from there, you have the restraints, the so-called right efforts. I prefer to call them right restraints. So you live a simple life. And the more simple you are, the easier it is to be mindful, and the easier it is to see what happens when you have things like desire or ill will coming up. It's not worth it. It's much easier to live peaceful, have few desires and ill will. Somebody makes a mistake, I make a mistake, you make a mistake, why do you have ill will for? That's the most crazy thing, because that's the nature of life, to go wrong. Why do you shout at life when it goes wrong? Shout at yourself when it goes wrong. So that way that the Eightfold Path, that's just so in brief, the Eightfold Path does mean you just the five hindrances get really, really less naturally. That's why, just when you start keep precepts, it's actually easier to meditate. And after you easier to meditate, you have restraint because you have your joy coming in simplicity and silence. And look, just living in this monastery, or being here in Jhana Grove, do you really value it? It's so peaceful in the morning, it's gorgeous. And so what do you want anything for? You find the joy, the happiness in a simple lifestyle, which means those hindrances of ill will and wanting don't come up. If it's not enough, I don't know what you like to eat in the morning or lunchtime, if there's not enough noodles, they all run out. Do you get angry? You find it's much more fun. And if you've got the last bowl of noodles, it's the last bowl, there's no more left, and you have to go out later on and get some more. And you see somebody going, oh, there's no noodles today. You give yours to them. Giving to others is just so much fun. Much more fun than eating it for yourself. It's true. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, what is the wisest way to make big life decisions? Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow. Procrastinate. You should decide to procrastinate, but don't make that decision yet. Put that off until another day. Now people say, Ajahn Brahm, these are big life decisions, they're important. Are they? Because sometimes we really think they are, but a lot of time you just put them off and you find they're not as important as you thought they were. How big is my hand? It's now so big I can't see any of you in this whole world. Mm-hmm. All I can see is my hand. Mm-hmm. Is my hand big? It's just I've got it too close to me. When I have perspective, I can see my hand, I can see it's one of you. That was the problem. We make it a big life decision and we just hold it too close to ourselves. So what usually happens, I mentioned this to somebody in the interviews today, there was this amazing lady, I don't mind saying this, Wani Nat. Remember Wani Nat? Her job was to, part of the life, she was working for social services, she was the one who had to make the final decision what child would be forcibly taken away from their parents, because it was more dangerous to be with their parents than be taken away. It could be drug addiction, it could be just unable to really cope with their children. Imagine doing that, to take a child away from their parents. And, you know, there's so much terrible things happened with the removal of children. I thought it was right, but it was wrong. But there's some cases where you have to do that. And she was the one who made those decisions. That's really stressful. But I always remember when she came to one of the retreats in North Perth. I never saw her in the first evening on Friday because she told me she came at midnight and just managed to get a room and have a rest. And good on her, she was a very good meditator. And she said she forgot all of those cases which she hadn't finished with yet, the really difficult decisions. And she wanted to have a rest and meditate. She really let that go. Good on her. And the result of that was that she was meditating 5 or 6 days into the retreat. And then her mind was really peaceful and calm. She'd forgotten about all those cases. And then one of the cases came up into her after her meditation. And she saw this incredible solution. I said, wow, that was an amazing solution. And then another one or two or three. And she went back to her room, wrote all those solutions down, forgot about them, and then just carried on meditating. When she went back to work, she enacted all those solutions. And they were brilliant. And she said it was the first time she realized how the power of meditation is when you really let things go. You forget about them. Subconsciously, the mind energizes itself. It becomes powerful and it can make those decisions, amazing decisions. That's why I also said about was it named Brian Josephson, the only Welshman who's won the Nobel Prize in Physics. He got that insight after he meditated. Quantum tunneling, foundation of high-speed computers, supercomputers, the thing was called. It's amazing, when you're very peaceful, that's how you can make big decisions in life. Just put it down, let it sort of germinate, but don't interfere with it. And then afterwards, the solution comes up by itself. Adam, I pay attention to wishes of loving kindness, and a lovely warm feeling spreads out from my heart through my body and mind. Is this a metanimitta? Yeah, it could be. But isn't it, it's not the right time of year to warm up your body. I get hot in this room. It's a very warm room. I know that some of you are cold-blooded creatures and you want as many heaters on as possible. But you try and resist loving-kindness meditation. It makes you too warm. Hot. Okay, I might be just trying to entertain you. Of course I do loving-kindness. It's a different type of warmness. Is this a metanimitta? The warm feeling, no, that's just... Nimitta, not really. Because what the metanimitta is and how that works is when you not just feel it, the next thing you have to do is to disembody it. In other words, it's not loving kindness to this group of people, it's not to myself, it's not just to all beings, it's loving kindness like to everything with no object it's going on to. So it's like just the sun, but not shining on planets. It's just the sun by itself, and it's just disembodied loving kindness. And then, of course, it becomes just like many nimittas, a beautiful light in the mind. And if you do that, that creates enormous nimittas, beautiful ones as well. Can't say too much, but I remember this monk I'm very close to when we used to do weekend retreats at Safety Bay, in Penguin Road, in that nun's place, a Christian nun's place. And I remember this monk I'm very close to, he was very tired, and so he had to do the breath meditation, he had to do meditation instruction. So what can you do to get some energy up? So I just combined metta meditation and breath meditation. So when you watch the breath, just with kindness, with love. Poor breath. You breathed in all your life and the breath has never let you down. It's worked so hard, it works day and night. So I just got out a commentary. This monk I know got a commentary out on the breath. And the breath became so beautiful very quickly. It was a combination of loving kindness and breath meditation. And that was really great. A great retreat for me. Also for this monk. I'm not supposed to say things. Sorry. It's getting late for me. I don't know why. It's not that late. But anyway, the energy was very strong. And beautiful meditations. And all the energy, wow. I was really zapped with energy. And even in the middle of the night, I slept a couple of hours. And then in the middle of the night, I can say this. You woke up, I had a dream. A very simple dream. A nimitta, beautiful nimitta, wow! And straight up, sitting up, and just had a wonderful meditation after that. And so that's one of the nicest retreats which I've had. Just really easy to do deep meditation. And the nimittas were golden and gorgeous. Easy. So you put loving kindness and breath together or something, and you're flying. Anyway, the feeling, yes, feeling's okay, but get it into like a light. That's much easier to work with. Leha, it's 8:10 now. There's quite a few more questions to go. So I don't think I'll be able to finish these off in the next 5 minutes. There's 1, 2, 3. Crikey, you've got so many questions on this one. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. What do you reckon? Shall we carry on for another 5 minutes or stop now? I'm not going to be able to answer all the questions tonight.
Carry on for another 5 minutes.
Another 5 minutes? Okay. Which question to answer? Here we go. Oh no. The long one. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in Upaklesa Sutta, read on Monday, are the disturbances to the stability of the Nimma specific expression of the five hindrances? Could you please relate each of these five different listed to the five hindrances? Doubt, the first one. Doubt is related to the hindrance of doubt. Obviously. The inattention is related to it's a lack of energy. So that would be related probably to, won't have desire there, probably to, strange enough, I'd give that the second hindrance, the ill will. Sloth and torpor, sloth and torpor. Fear is a part of restlessness and worry. Elation is part of restlessness and worry. Inertia, what is inertia? Just, it's almost like that's part of inertia. It's not desire. It's not. It's a bit of ill will being there, and a bit of sloth and torpor as well. Excess energy, excess restlessness, deficiency of energy, sloth and torpor, longing, the first hindrance of desire, perception of diversity. Oh, that was actually wrong view. So where does that one come in? That's actually coming in from a bit of longing. Clearly you want to control the nimitta. That's one of the things which I was taught when I first learnt about these things. Control it. Expand it, contract it, move it here, move it there. And I thought that's a silly thing to do. And this perception of diversity was part of that. Excessive meditation on the form, again, that's desire. So, yeah, they have got counterparts to the five hindrances, but these are special parts of those five hindrances. And the most important one is fear, excitement, and doubt. So give yourself the benefit of the doubt. If you see something, it almost certainly is an imitator. And don't be afraid. Enjoy. And don't get excited. Get excited afterwards. The wow response should come at the end. Dear Ajahn Brahm, for a busy layperson, what would be a recommended daily time to develop a meditation practice for a calm and tranquil mind? Thank you. The best time to meditate during the day is always now. The worst time to meditate is later. You get that? So you have a time and you feel like, yeah, let's meditate, just do it. Got 1 minute left. During the day I experience peaceful states of being. However, every night I experience disturbing dreams, waking up in the morning feeling unsettled. Could you please share your view on this dynamic of the mind and how to react or not react when waking up feeling unsettled? Yeah, one of the reasons for that is because you're having a peaceful states of being during the daytime. You're getting energy. And just usually don't have much energy when you're sleeping, which means you have, you know, just hardly any dreams at all. And now that energy is really, really strong. So you have exciting, interesting dreams. First of all, I would say just the right, if it's really strange or dynamic in the dreams, then when you wake up, write them down. And you send them over to Steven Spielberg over in DreamWorks. That's why they call it DreamWorks, isn't it? And then you can have the script for a new movie. Is that a good idea? But no. What you really need to do is when you go to sleep at night, you know, you tuck yourself in, make yourself nice and comfortable. And if this is a problem for you, just tell yourself, this evening I will have peaceful, calm dreams. This evening I'll have peaceful, calm dreams. This evening I'll have peaceful, calm dreams. Set your mind up that way. And then go to sleep. You will be surprised how effective that is. Okay, three more, four more to do, but it's 8:15. I promise we'll stop now, so I'll do this once again tomorrow. Is that okay? Yeah, good. It's usually the first person who says, ahem, or no, let's go on. The first person who answers that, shall we go on or shall we stop, is usually the one who wins. So, very good, you got in there fast enough. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. Now, because there is, you know, I try to get through all the questions. So, if you've asked a lot of questions so far, now please give other people a chance. Usually we ask people only one question in the evening time. And if you've already asked a question, you've got a better question, then take out the former one and then put in your new one. Because after a while, you get used to the handwriting. And you can tell who writes the question. No. So have a wonderful evening. Did I do this? Yeah. I did do the sadhus, didn't I? Yeah. See, that's the trouble. When you live in the present moment... Okay, have a good night.